Stanley, this is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. World condemnation has been pouring in over the treatment of Christians in the Iraqi city of Mosul. Christian residents were forced from their homes this weekend at gunpoint, many with nothing but the clothes they were wearing. The message was, leave now or convert to Islam or die. It's one more harsh step by the Sunni group known as ISIS for Islamic State in Iraq and Syria to gain control of more Iraqi territory. And that's part of a broader ISIS goal to establish what's called a caliphate, a region-wide United Islamic Nation. The rapid success of ISIS in northern Iraq has both alarmed and baffled many, including many Americans who don't understand why Iraq continues to be shredded by such intense sectarian violence. Today in The Exchange, our guest Leslie Hazelton helps us untangle some of this. She's a longtime journalist, author, and psychologist with an expertise in Islam. Her new book is called The First Muslim, The Story of Muhammad. Let's hear from you this hour in The Exchange. Call in. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Leslie Hazelton joins us from Dartmouth College, where she'll be speaking tomorrow morning. And Leslie, great to have you. Thanks for giving us your time this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Laura.
Well, there are so many terms used when we read about Middle East conflict, so let's just look at a couple of those if we could. First of all, with ISIS, as I said, its broad goal is said to be to create an Islamic caliphate. What is that?
ISIS, of course, is the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, led by a particularly violent fringe character called al-Baghdadi. Their aim, which is not supported by anybody other than a few thousand of his followers, is to set up, as he says, a caliphate. What does caliphate mean? In the years following the death of Muhammad, believe it or not, this goes back 1,400 years.
Wow.
And it goes back to Iraq itself because it all happened in Iraq, not in Arabia, but in Iraq. After the death of Muhammad, there was a huge dispute over who would be his successor. And the Arabic word for successor is Khalifa, or in English, Caliph, or Caliph. And this was basically, we'll get into this a little bit more, maybe as time goes on, the origin of the split between the Sunni stream of Islam and the Shia stream of Islam. But, you know, the fundamentalist Muslims, as opposed to the majority of Muslims, fundamentalist Muslims refer to the first four caliphs as the Rashidun, the four righteous ones, because they are the ones they claim who had both the spiritual and the political authority. And after that, the caliphate became mainly a political authority, and then you got the establishment of a separate religious authority under the, you know, various imams and ayatollahs and what have you. So they look back to those first 50 years or so after the death of Muhammad as the golden age of Islam, which speaks only to their sheer ignorance of the history of their own faith. Such ignorance, of course, is not unique to fundamentalist Muslims. If you look at fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Jews, are equally ignorant of the histories of their faiths too. Fundamentalism basically is based in ignorance. Couldn't thrive without it. Let's go back to the particular ignorance here. Let's look at these first four caliphs, these first four successors to Muhammad. Three of the four were assassinated, two of them by other Muslims. One of them was incredibly corrupt.
So no golden age there, really.
There was absolutely no golden age. When you look at it, it's a very, very bitter dispute over, what else? Power and territory. Because when Muhammad died, and this was in the year 632, he had more or less united all the tribes of Arabia, and he'd done this at a time. You have to look at the sort of more general geopolitics of the area, when to the north, You had two huge empires which had been fighting each other for 800 years to exhaustion. You had to the northwest, you had the Byzantine Empire, right? Christian Empire. To the northeast, you had the Persian Empire, Zoroastrian. And they had basically fought each other to a standstill. And the place where the two met, where the clashes were most intense, was, of course, of all places, Iraq. But because, so to the south, you had this whole huge area of Arabia suddenly united, right? Just as everything to the north of them was falling apart. And the Arabs, the Arabians, were traitors. So they didn't just sort of surge out of the south and take over the north. They were already, you know, as traders are, very involved in the areas they traded with. They had farms in Palestine. They had homes and estates in Egypt. They had date orchards in Iraq and so on, mansions in Damascus. So they were part and parcel of the lands they traded with. And as their power came together and the Byzantine and Persian power fell apart, there was a vacuum of power. So what happened was that the newly united Arabs from Arabia, literally Arabs, under Islam, filled that vacuum of power, what's usually called the Arab conquest. Which
so that was a great moment for
it was a great
this
moment,
area
yeah.
of the world. But shortly yeah. after Muhammad dies, as you've written, Leslie, things really fall apart. There's this issue of who's going to be the caliphate, if I could put it that. And there's been fighting ever since, it sounds like.
Well, not quite ever since. It flares. It comes and it goes. And it really depends on the stability as a whole. We'll get to that. But what happened was that when you have a whole huge area united like this under the banner of Islam, what you're getting is tribute, which is basically an older word for taxes. What you're getting is a huge treasury. What you're getting is a lot of money and a lot of power. And the dispute then becomes over money and power. That dispute then becomes presented in terms of religion, in terms of who is the most faithful, who is the most correct, who is the real religious leader, and so on. And religion is basically used as the excuse, as it always is. It's very, very easy to manipulate people on religious grounds because religion, in a sense, is sheer emotion. You know, when you talk about belief, you're not talking about knowledge. You're not talking about fact. The whole point of belief is that it contains within itself the possibility of unbelief, of not believing. It's a leap of faith, and that makes it deeply, deeply, deeply emotional. It becomes a major means of identity. So when you have a central authority that breaks down, as happened in Iraq, especially after the United States went in the year 2003, when you have a central authority that breaks down, people will then fall back on, you know, when you can't say when being Iraqi doesn't do it anymore because nobody knows what it means anymore, then you become your next greatest identity, which is either Shia or Sunni. Now, do you want to go into the difference between Shia and Sunni?
I definitely do, but let me invite our listeners also to join us, Leslie. And then, yes, that's huge, yeah. And I would love to go there, the differences between these two and how they go way, way back. But let me also remind everyone that you can join us with your questions and comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And our guest today in the exchange is Leslie Hazelton. She's a longtime journalist. She was based for many years in the Middle East. She's also an author and a psychologist. She's written several books about religion, including her latest, The First Muslim, also After the Prophet, which talks about the Sunni-Shia split. She also blogs on these topics and more under the title of The Accidental Theologist. Again, you can join us with your questions and comments about some of these big, big issues from way back affecting the Muslim world. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And yes, Leslie, let's go there because, as I said, one of your earlier books was exactly about this topic, a topic that many Americans, myself included, are confused on, why Sunni and Shia have these just intense, violent disagreements.
Mm-hmm. First, one more point about ISIS, the Islamic State of in Iraq and Syria. This expulsion of the of Christians in Mosul under a threat of death if they don't convert is so totally anti-Islamic. It's like most fundamentalisms of all stripes, it's a total travesty of the faith it purports to represent. One of the most famous sayings in the Quran is, Muhammad is told to say to his detractors, to you, your religion, to me, mine. This seems to have totally escaped fundamentalists like the head of ISIS. It's a travesty of Islam. Then all fundamentalisms are a travesty of whatever religion they claim to represent. And of course, they always claim very, very loudly and very violently. Now, Shia and Sunni, okay, the moment Muhammad died, the basic problem is that Muhammad had no sons. He did have one son who died in infancy.
And several daughters,
so,
right?
He had four daughters. But in 7th century Arabia, a daughter wasn't going to be the successor, right? So in the lack of a son who would have been the natural successor, as it was, the question was, who was going to lead this newly united Arabia? There were two main candidates, let's see. One was Ali, his son-in-law and his first cousin, who was very, very close to him. And there was a whole party, a whole group that supported Ali, and they were called the Shi'at Ali, the followers of Ali, which then became contracted to simply Shia.
That's where the word comes from.
That's where the word comes from.
I see. I didn't know that.
Uh-huh. And then there was another group that said, no, it has to be done by consensus. I don't know how much experience you've had with consensus. Consensus is very big in the Northwest where I live right now. And it's a process of you just keep on going until everybody who opposes whatever the majority think gets so worn down that they're just, oh, okay, all right. it's a very tricky thing, consensus. But it claimed that the consensus went to Abu Bakr, who was a father-in-law of Muhammad and a very close associate of his, who then did in fact become the first caliph. And they. Okay, we'll get into where Sunnah comes from after we come back.
Yes, absolutely. Leslie, thank you very much. And we will be back in just a moment. We'll hear a little bit more about this Sunni-Shia split and take your calls and questions as well. The number 1-800-892-6477. More with Leslie Hazleton in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is where you can find New Hampshire stories you'll want to share with others. Click over now for a special three-part series on a husband, his wife, and the liver she was willing to donate to save his life. There's always something new worth sharing at NHPR.org. Mostly sunny for today, highs from mid to upper 80s, mostly clear tonight, some areas of fog after midnight, humid, lows tonight in the 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Artisan's Corner in downtown Wolfboro, hosting artist Marcia Christensen and her son Tim, a ceramic artist, during Wolfboro's Art Walk this Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Artisan'sCornerNH.com. And Center for Physical Therapy and Exercise, keeping the community in motion since 1989, providing warm water pool therapy at their Nashua Clinic. More information at cpte.net. 920. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking more closely at the Sunni-Shia split within Islam. Author Leslie Hazleton is with us. She spent 13 years living in the Middle East, reporting for the New York Times, Harper's, and more. Fascinated by Islam, she returned to America and wrote After the Prophet, the story of this fierce division between the religion's two largest sects. Her new book is called The First Muslim. It's a biography of Muhammad. And Leslie Hazleton will be speaking at Dartmouth College tomorrow morning. We'll put a link on our website to that event if you want to find out more. You can join us now with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Leslie, going back to your explanation of this split between Sunni and Shia. So it seems like, from what you said, it boils down to this disagreement after Muhammad dies, of who is the rightful leader.
Correct. So on the one hand, you had the Shi'at Ali, the followers of Ali, reduced to Shia in common parlance. On the other hand, you had those who supported Abu Bakr, who is Ali was a son-in-law of Muhammad, Abu Bakr was a father-in-law of Muhammad. And they maintained in contradistinction to the Shia, that they were following the Sunnah, the tradition of Muhammad. And in fact, the Shia followed the same tradition. But by calling themselves Sunnis, those who follow the Sunnah, as related in various reports, hadith about Muhammad's life, Muhammad's statements and so on, it's as though the Sunnis actually claimed the Sunnah for themselves. So that's how the two identities became fixed, as it were. And what's happened is that throughout history, you know, we tend to focus only on the times when these two groups, by the way, the Shia, about 20% of all Muslims worldwide. What makes it even more sensitive, however, is that, and more sensitive definitely to Americans and to the West, is that wherever the oil is thickest underground, that is in Iran, Iraq, Kazakhstan, various other places, eastern Saudi Arabia, wherever the oil is thickest underground, the Shia are the majority overground.
That's interesting. So the mm-hmm. Sunnis, even though they are greater in numbers, they're less rich in resources.
Yep. And it also, it hasn't been helped at all in recent years. As I say, for most of history, Shia and Sunni have lived side by side in maybe not peace and brotherhood, but definitely tolerating each other's existence, right? And it's called coexistence. You don't necessarily love each other, but you live and let live. To you, your religion, to be mine, as it says in the Quran. But at times of crisis, at times of when leadership is unclear, it comes very, very much to the fore. Partly that's what's happening now. And you have this sort of standoff, or this not so much standoff, between Iran, which is presenting itself as the leader of the Shia world, Shia majority country, of course, and Saudi Arabia, which is presenting itself as the leader of the Sunni world. Both, of course, practicing very extreme forms of their religion.
So it gets back to what you said, you know, your average Sunni or your average Shia live and let live, tolerate side by side. But mm-hmm. there are these times when people who want power, Leslie, mm-hmm. use religion as a basis for religious intolerance and, yeah. and extreme violence, as we're seeing. Is that what you
mean? It always comes down to power. It always comes down to the thirst for power, the grab for power, and the manipulation of religion, usually based on an incredibly ignorant and primitive interpretation of that religion or concept of that religion. I call it highlighter religion, you know, because what happens is that, you know, they go through holy, you know, sacred texts and so on with a yellow highlighter and just totally, you know, quote, totally out of context, whichever bits they want. You know.
Highlight those pieces that speak to them and forget what Muhammad said about
exactly.
tolerance.
Exactly.
You know, if you could talk a little bit more about interpretation, and then I do want to get our listeners involved. So beyond the fact that you say these conflicts often flare up because of people who want power and money and, mm. and oil resources mm. and so forth, are there religious practices, Leslie, that are different? For example, you know, there are some religious practices in a Catholic church that you're not going to find in a Protestant church and vice versa. Are there, you know, do they correct. Approach their practice of the religion differently as well?
To some extent, not to a very large extent. The Shia, because they maintain that the line of succession should have gone through Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law and his first cousin, and then through Ali's sons and their sons and so on and so on, have this thing about they call it Al-Bayt, the people of the house of Muhammad. And the house of Muhammad in the same sense, for instance, as the British throne is called the House of Windsor, right? So they will also, you know, there's a long line of what they call imams. The Shia do not recognize the caliphate at all. They call Ali the first imam, his sons the second and third imam, and the third imam, Hussein, was he and most of his family were massacred quite horribly at Karbala in Iraq. Again, in Iraq, it all happens in Iraq.
Mm, wow.
48 years after Muhammad's death. And this is an event, the massacre at Karbala, that is commemorated every year in Shia communities with passion plays and marches and so on. You know, you've probably heard of the Oberammergau, Roman Catholic passion plays in Austria. These passion plays are far more widespread and go far deeper, and are still held every year. And it's a feeling on the Shia side of dispossession that they were the rightful heirs, and on the Sunni side, there's a report, a hadith, right? A report of what Muhammad said. Some of these are more reliable and some of them are less, and many of them came into being hundreds of years after Muhammad's death, so their reliability is very open to question very often. But one of them has Muhammad saying, "My community," meaning the community of Islam, "will never agree in error," which sounds wonderful, except that it is then taken to mean by Sunni extremists that if you disagree with them, then you are in error and are not a real Muslim.
That highlighter philosophy, as you talked earlier.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Highlight the
and
texts
this is,
that,
yeah, this
that
is
work
a means
for you.
Of, yeah, and it's a means, of course, of otherizing other Muslims, right? So the Sunni fundamentalists do not recognize the Shia as Muslims, which, you know, to an outsider looking on, it is absurd, but then so is fundamentalism.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're learning more today about the Sunni-Shia split that seems to be behind much of the conflict we see today in the Middle East. Leslie Hazelton is with us, longtime journalist based in that area. She's also an author and a psychologist. Her blog is The Accidental Theologist. Her latest book is called The First Muslim. Another one of her books having to do with this is called After the Prophet, and it's about this Sunni-Shia split that we're talking about. The phone number for you to join us on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Leslie, here's an email that came in from Ben in Hudson, who says, "Thank you for this dialogue. I appreciate your guest drawing the difference between Sunni and Shiites." He says, "Could she also briefly talk about Sufis and Salafists, two other lesser-known branches of Islam?" Ben, it's a great question. Leslie, do you know?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I'd hate to put Sufis and Salafists together even in the same sentence.
Why?
This is the more mystical trend of Islam. It's not limited to either Shia or Sunni. Sufis are much more concerned not with the letter of the law, not with legalistic Islam, but more with the spirit. You know, St. Paul once said, you know, the what was it he said in letter to the Corinthians, I think, "The letter kills, the spirit gives life," which I think is the most wonderful quote. You know, it's very odd for an agnostic Jew talking about Islam to be quoting St. Paul, I know, but this is the kind of peculiar existential situation I often find myself in these days.
Well, there are connections,
but he was right,
between all these world religions, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
yes, exactly. So the Sufi is far more concerned with the spirit, and it's Sufi organizations are I think most far more open-spirited, open-hearted, and so on. Salafis, and again, let's just put these in completely different sentences. Salafi is a movement on the extreme right wing, the very ultra conservative Islam, and very, very devoted to Salafi. Basically, comes from the word for ancestors. The ancestors in question being those four righteous caliphs I talked about earlier, the Rashidun, and a desire to go back to the age, that age which they've made in their imaginations into a kind of golden age, and which, of course, was not. In fact, it ended, as I say, with that horrible massacre in Karbala of Muhammad's grandson and his family.
So why do we hear so little about the Sufis and Salafists? Is it because they're just tiny amounts of people, or they just tend to keep to themselves and don't fight? Or why do we not hear as much about them?
No, well, we hear actually do hear a lot about the Salafis, who are the kind of right wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, if you like. The you can call you know, there are subtle differences, but you can call the Wahhabi style of Islam in Saudi Arabia is basically Salafi.
I see.
Yes, this nutcase al-Baghdadi who's declared himself caliph for him and his few thousand followers, nobody else recognizes or pays any attention to that, except, of course, to this horrible violence that he is committing, and not only against Christians, but against other Muslims. And this is the point, by the way, about Muslim extremist fundamentalism, is that they kill infinitely more, not infinitely, I wish, wrong word, but that they kill far, far more Muslims than non-Muslims.
How much do you think, Leslie, your average American Muslim feels this Sunni-Shia division? I mean, you've written that 50% of American Muslims have never set, you know, don't set foot inside a mosque. So how much do you think your average Muslim, practicing or not, feels this divide, feels this split that goes back so far?
Well, I can't talk for the average American Muslim, but I can tell you an experience I had the first time I spoke to... I was invited to speak to an organization called Muslims for Peace in New Jersey. And I accepted. And this was after the Prophet had come out. And I remember asking on the phone, well, what kind of audience are we talking about? And it had been presented to me as a sort of interfaith event. And he said, well, you know, mixed. And I said, okay. So I walk in expecting to find, you know, this banquet hall, 600, you know, people full of Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And I find it's full of Muslims. And I'm the only non-Muslim there.
And you're
and I'm
talking
sort of like,
about, yeah.
And that's when I realized that when he said mixed, he meant mixed Sunni and Shia.
I see.
But, you know, it was actually a great event. I sort of realized as I walked in, I thought, wait a minute, there's something familiar here. I may be the only Jew here, or the only non-Muslim here, but there's something familiar about what's going on here. All the men were sort of grouped, you know, talking very, very seriously about serious matters, and the women were running around, you know, preparing the food for afterwards, and the kids were running around getting in everybody's under everybody's feet. And I thought, this is like talking to a hall full of Orthodox Jews. I get it. And it was.
Well, how did they feel about this, you know, this split that we see that has caused so much violence, you know? And do they feel these differences themselves in their daily lives or not?
No, they go to separate mosques.
Just like Catholics and Protestants, yeah.
Precisely. You will find in a Shia mosque, you will probably find a portrait of Ali and his son Hussein, and of course portraits of any kind under strict Salafi or Wahhabi Sunni law are forbidden of any kind whatsoever. There's a slightly different style of prayer, but really, you know, a Muslim of good heart and good faith, it doesn't matter if they see themselves or if they align themselves as Sunni or Shia. A Muslim of good heart and good faith has far more in common with a Christian or a Jew of good heart and good faith than they have with any fundamentalist who claims to speak for them.
Let's take some calls if we could, Leslie. And the number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan's calling from Franklin. Hi, Dan. You're on the exchange with Leslie Hazelton. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Fine.
My question, we did, I was a soldier with the National Guard of the 1st to the 172nd. I did a tour in Iraq from 2004 to 2005, roughly. We were stationed near Safwan in Unkasar province. A lot of stuff that had happened out there was part of the thing, kind of like what was going on with ISIS now, they had what they called the Mardi Army. But there was another group that you had just briefly mentioned it in part of your conversation with the Wahhabi. My question for you is, where did they come from? How did that, where did they mix between Sunni and Shia? And hopefully you can give us some insight on that.
Yeah, and Dan, thanks for calling, especially given your experience right there on the ground. So really appreciate the call. Go ahead, Leslie.
Yeah, and thank you for your service. Okay, Mahdi Army, the Mahdi. I talked before about Ali and how his son, Ali, the son-in-law of Muhammad, and how his son, Hussein, Muhammad's grandson, was massacred at Karbala. There were some survivors. And they went on to form a line of 12 imams, Shia imams, even as the Sunni caliphates were gaining more and more power and so on. And they came to an end about 100 years later with the 12th Imam. There were only 12 Imams. So we're talking here about Imam with a capital I, not lowercase I, the Imam who leads prayer in a mosque. And the 12th Imam went into hiding. He disappeared in a well in Samarra, by the way, which is one of the great shrines that is has now been attacked and demolished again by ISIS. Went into a cave beneath it and went into what they call occultation. And think of that in the astronomical term as when, you know, in an eclipse, the moon is occulted by the shadow of the earth. So to return at the end of days, and this is, you know, the legend with Jesus on one hand, Moses on the other, and so on. So he is known as the Mahdi, which is basically the Messiah. The Mahdi army was formed to basically came into being in response to, in an opposition to the American entry into Iraq in 2003, fighting for independence. And Iraq, by the way, is a vastly majority Shia country. And so that's the Mahdi army. Wahhabis came out of Saudi Arabia.
That's what I think of when I hear that word.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
And what happened was early in the 20th century, there was a marriage, and many of these things are sealed by marriage. There was a marriage between the Wahhabi tribe and the Sauds. So the Wahhabis have taken over. The Wahhabis are fiercely conservative, fiercely fundamentalist. And they have taken over the whole the administration of the religious side of the Saudi state. It's a kind of... It's a ghastly repressive regime in Saudi Arabia. And what they've been doing is, in order to prevent opposition to this regime from even stronger fundamentalists, they've been basically exporting extremism, supporting Wahhabi extreme conservative interpretations of Islam worldwide with basically American oil money. So, you know, indirectly, America, because of its reliance on oil, because of our reliance on, quote-unquote, our good friends in Saudi Arabia, one of the most repressive regimes in the world, basically America has been supporting and financing opposition to it throughout the world.
Wow. All right.
Indirectly.
Well, lots of folks want to jump in our conversation, Leslie. So after a short break, we'll go right back to your calls and questions. Thank you so much for that one, Dan. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. More in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
Don't miss out on $2,000 worth of gas. That's enough to fuel a cross-country trip several times over. And that's what's on the table with the early bird prize for NHPR's summer car raffle. But not for much longer. You only have a few days left to get in on this, so get your raffle tickets now, just $50 each or three for $100. Before you do anything else, call 1-888-805-NHPR or go to nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Andy Summer Playhouse, presenting the world premiere of the multimedia play The Block, now through July 26. Information at andysummerplayhouse.org. And the Heart and Vascular Institute at Portsmouth Regional Hospital, dedicated to providing life second chances. Borthwick Avenue, Portsmouth, and online at portsmouthhospital.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we sit down with Betsy Gardella, President and CEO here at NHPR. Today in The Exchange, author Leslie Hazelton is with us. Her latest book is called The First Muslim. It's a biography of Muhammad. We're looking at the religious roots of the Sunni-Shia divide in Islam. That's the subject of another book, by the way, by Leslie Hazelton. You can join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Leslie, lots of people with questions calling in. So let's go right back to the phones.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's you know, we hear so much about this, and it's hard for your average person who's just trying to get through their day to understand it. So this is great. Let's go to Ida in Andover, Vermont. Hi, Ida. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. First, let me say this program is extremely fascinating.
and I'm enjoying every moment of it. I'm learning so much. My question for Leslie Hazleton is, why don't we hear more outrage from the non-extremist Islamists? Why don't we hear more condemnation of the extreme behavior and violence?
Thank you, Ida, for the call. And it's a question that a lot of people have had, Leslie. You know, after 9/11, many Muslims said, look, this is not us. Our faith does not condone this. Many, many, many people have said this, including on our air. So why aren't those voices getting through?
Why aren't we hearing them? The voices are being expressed. They are most definitely being expressed. The thing is, they're not being reported. You know, it's the old thing, flames lead. So if somebody says something inflammatory, that makes the news. If somebody says something specifically anti-inflammatory, that does not make the news. I cannot tell you how many. I mean, first of all, let's distinguish between Islamists and Muslims. Islamists are those who advocate, you know, the political Islam, a government based, you know, on very, very strict Islamic law. And that's a very much a minority position. I know that most American Muslims are shocked, dismayed, aghast at what is said in the name of Islam by fundamentalists and extremists, both here and abroad, just as many Jews are aghast and dismayed at what is being done in their name, for instance, in right now, these days, in Gaza. Just as many Christians are just deeply, deeply disgusted by those who kill, claiming to defend life, you know, in the name of life, who kill doctors and gynecologists and so on in the name of life. These things are deeply, deeply disgusting to people of real faith, of true faith, to people who are not fanatics. The trouble is, first of all, there are two things at work here. One is that peace doesn't make great news. The nature of news, war is news, peace is not. And I know this because I've reported on peace. And it's very difficult to grasp the attention against all the flames, the bullets, the bombs, and so on. Peace, basically, I mean, the most basic definition of peace is the absence of all that. How do you talk about an absence? How do you talk about people working together, and so on? But the other thing is that, you know, when those extremists start up, the rest of us get backed into corners. We start feeling defensive. We start feeling as though if somebody attacks, you know, if somebody says, well, you know, look at ISIS, look how violent those Muslims are, then nonviolent, peaceable Muslims, the vast majority of Muslims, feel that they're being criticized too, because the actions of just a few Muslims are being counted as those of all. And of course, this happened especially after 9/11, when you had 19 inhuman zealots, fanatics, who were then taken, who were described as Muslims. In fact, what they were doing, as I say, was an obscene, most obscene travesty of Islam and of all the principles of Islam. But this was taken as Islam, and that puts all Muslims on the defensive. They feel like they're under attack. And, you know, this is inevitable. Therefore, those voices of real faith and of coexistence and of cooperation get muted.
Well, Ida, thank you very much for the question. And let's go to Ray in Jaffrey. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Yes. Good morning, Laura. I wanted to ask Lisa about the interconnectivity between Hinduism, Christianity, and the Muslim faith along the lines of the science of impressions. That is, that Krishna was a former incarnation of Christ, and Christ overshadowed Jesus, and Jesus overshadowed Muslim. I mean, Muhammad.
I'm really not following you at all here. I'm sorry. This is not a question I'm capable of handling.
Sorry. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling in, Ray. And sorry about that. It's a big, big topic with a lot of facets, but I appreciate you chiming in. And let's go to Douglas in Amherst. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you very much. I just had a question for Lindsay, and that was, I used to live in the Lebanon, and I taught at the university in Beirut for a while. And during that time, I observed that in the parliament in Lebanon, the Sunni and the Shia seem to work fairly well together, and certainly in the society there doesn't seem to be much of a problem. Yet when you get to Iraq, there's a huge split. And then when you throw the Kurds in, that makes it even worse.
When were you in Lebanon, Douglas?
Well, I was in the Lebanon in the 60s.
Yeah, because so Lebanon had a civil war, too,
yes,
in the 80s, I
was there for one of them, and on the heels of it. And I left after the war.
But your experience there was Sunni and Shia are perfectly capable of working together in the right circumstances. Is that what you're saying, Douglas?
That's my impression.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for the call. Leslie, your thoughts there?
Totally agree. Under the right circumstances, without outside interference, sooner or later it can be worked out because the differences are really pretty minor. It's at times of turmoil, at times, as I say, of weak central control, and which allows outside interference, which allows Wahhabis to come in, which allows Israel had a lot to do with that disturbance, with that civil war in Lebanon too, with people coming in from the outside taking sides, saying, you know, oh, we're with the Shia, oh, we're with the Sunni, these ones are right and those ones are right. You know, after I wrote After the Prophet, people kept on asking me, well, which side do you think was right, Shia or Sunni? And it's sort of like, just please read the book. It doesn't matter of who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah.
It's who am I to make this judgment? Who is any human being to make such a judgment? We tend to think all the time of, you know, here, for instance, I arrived in Dartmouth College last night, and I was sitting on the green late at night smoking a cigarette, and I hear two very, very loud. And thinking how calm and serene it was and how lucky I was to be here and not obsessively following what's happening in the Middle East as I usually do. And then I hear two very, very loud raised voices, angry voices coming towards me. And they're arguing about who's right, who's at fault, Israel, Gaza and so on. And I'm thinking, you know, this gets you nowhere. We can go back. How far do you want to go back? How eagerly do you want to establish your own self-righteousness and so on at the cost of all these lives that are being lost because you insist that you are right and that the other is wrong? Maybe we can all just agree that we're all wrong. At least that way we can stop killing each other.
You've also looked, Leslie, at how women are talked about in some of these earliest Islamic texts and by some of these early, early Islamic leaders. How Muhammad viewed the role of women. You write about his wife, fascinating character. Yeah. What's your understanding of how women were viewed in those very early days of the religion?
Well, by Muhammad, this is one of the, you know, things that I know comes as quite some news to many, many people. You know, there's this image of Muhammad as the lecherous polygamist, all those wives and so on and so on. What's not known is that he was married in an extraordinary monogamous marriage of great love and respect to his first wife, Khadija, for 24 years until her death. And it is absolutely clear that, in fact, after her death, he mourned it every single day until his own death. They had four daughters and one son that died in infancy. She died. We don't hear much about her because she died before he became a political leader. He was still, you know, sort of the leader of a very small group that was under severe attack from the powers that be of the time. And it was only after her death that he became a political leader. And as political leaders of the time did, made several marriages, nine more marriages, in fact. These were diplomatic marriages, as every leader of the time made. And I think you can get an indication as to the quality of these marriages from the fact that of the nine wives, of the nine late-life wives, only one was a virgin at marriage, as she obviously, she lived longer than anybody, so she kept on reminding people of this, which is how we know it for so sure, Aisha. Not one of them bore him a child. Not one of them had a child with him. So it's this wasn't about luxury. This was about diplomacy, about, you know, marriage was used in the Middle East. In fact, it was used among European royal houses way into the 20th century. It was used to create diplomatic alliances.
In terms of how Mohammed, especially in those early days, felt about the role of women, what they should be allowed to do and what they shouldn't, what do some of those early texts tell us? What does the Quran tell us about this? Because as you know, Leslie, you know, different Muslim countries, the status of women is different in various countries. In Saudi Arabia, they can't even drive. You know, in other countries, they're full-fledged citizens and they hold jobs and so forth.
Well,
so how have these
a lot of the intense repression of women's rights in conservative Muslim majority countries is due not to anything that's in the Quran. In fact, it goes completely against what is written in the Quran. It's due to much later interpretations by an all-male clergy, of course, by those white-bearded sages, which have made, you know, so many problems, not just in Islam, but also in Judaism and Christianity. The matter of the veil, for instance. Nowhere in the Quran does it say that women should be veiled. It says that women and men should dress modestly. That's all it says. Women and men should dress modestly. So where did the veil come from? This is not in the Quran, but this is in the earliest histories. Muhammad, by the time he became a leader, in, you know, the last years of his life, he died at age 62. The last years of his life, he was the leader of this huge thing. And he was living in these very, very close quarters. No grand palaces and so on. No great mosques and so on. And with nine wives. And there was no privacy. Quite simply, no privacy at all. So a curtain was hung between the part of the room where he, you know, met with all the delegations coming and so on, and the part of the room that, that the wives were in order to give them some privacy. This curtain, over time, way after Muhammad's death, became a kind of mini curtain over the face, which was, oh, by the way, in imitation of upper class women in Persia. It was an old tradition. And what it said that, you know, if a woman who wears a veil obviously can't actually do anything, can't work with her hands, can't work in the fields and so on because the veil will get in the way, became a symbol of elite women.
I see.
And after Muhammad's death, you know, the remaining wives, the surviving widows, were the elite women. And then, of course, it took on because everybody wanted to be like Muhammad's wives and so on. So you got introduced this idea of actually wearing literally a face veil. But nowhere in the Quran does it say that women should cover their heads, should cover their faces and so on. It does say cover your breasts. That's it.
You know, your own interest in this subject, if we could just close out with this, because it's really interesting, Leslie. Your own interest in this subject, you've written that, you know, you grew up a Jewish girl in a Catholic school.
Still am.
So clearly exposed to a lot of different faiths. And the title of your blog is The Accidental Theologist. Uh-huh. So at what point did you say, wow, even though I am not a religious person, I'm fascinated by these matters of faith?
Oh, God, yeah. I always was. It was sort of like, you know, the Middle East. I lived for 13 years in Jerusalem and have remained very attached to the place ever since, even though the Jerusalem I knew basically no longer exists, I'm afraid to say. The Israel I knew no longer exists. But the you know, this is the one place in the world, well, the whole of the Middle East, is where religion and politics are most intricately intertwined. And you've got this hugely volatile arena. Now, I trained as a psychologist, right? So for a psychologist who was also a journalist and then became a writer, it's sort of like, it's oh, whoa. And I started this whole series of books back in the year 2000. After I moved to Seattle, it was a means of, you know, I wrote a biography of Mary, as in Virgin, a biography of Jezebel, as in not Virgin, and then, you know, the history of the Shia Sunni split and the biography of Muhammad. These were all means of, you know, once I'd left the Middle East. Physically, I could sit literally halfway around the world at a distance of either 1,400, 2,000, 3,000 years and sort of be there and be here at the same time, be then and be now at the same time. So for me, it's I see these all very much as Middle Eastern books, as books that are of the Middle East, where it's the one part of the world, I think, that has the oldest history in the world and yet in a certain sense has no history at all, because what happened then is very, very much part of what is happening now. And I don't think there's any way to understand what's happening now without understanding what happened then and how large a place it takes in people's minds and hearts.
Well, that's why we're glad you were able to join us today, Leslie, because there is so much going on and it's hard to understand where it all starts. Thank you for helping us untangle this a little bit. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
That's Leslie Hazelton, again, longtime journalist based in the Middle East. She's written several books about religion, including her latest, The First Muslim. If you want to find out more about her talk at Dartmouth College tomorrow morning, you can find a link on our website, nhpr.org. And the conversation continues after the program is over on the air on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Mikesell. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. Don't miss out on $2,000 worth of gas. That's enough to fuel a cross-country trip several times over. And that's what's on the table at the early bird prize for NHPR's summer car raffle. But not for much longer. You only have a few days left to get in on this, so get your raffle tickets now, just $50 each or three for $100. Before you do anything else, call 1-888-805-NHPR or go to nhpr.org. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and Pine Hill Waldorf School, an independent kindergarten and elementary school developing creative, free-thinking individuals. More information at pinehill.org/enroll. And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Cairo yesterday. They'll try to broker a ceasefire between Israel and the militant Palestinian group Hamas. Their visit follows some of the deadliest days of fighting between Israelis and Palestinians since the last ground war in 2009. More than 500 Palestinians, 27 Israelis, have died since fighting began July 8th. Israeli fighters say their mission is to destroy a network of cross-border tunnels that Hamas is using to infiltrate Israel. The latest on the crisis in Gaza, and prospects for a truce, first the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A train carrying the bodies of those who died on the downed Malaysia Airlines jet has arrived in Kharkiv, Ukraine. The bodies were released by pro-Russian separatists. They had put the bodies in refrigerated rail cars. The militants have also handed over flight data recorders from the jet to Malaysian investigators. European Union foreign ministers are under pressure to take a unified stance against Russia after the downing of the passenger plane. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, it's not yet clear how far European governments are willing to go.
With widespread suspicion, Ukrainian rebels shot down MH17 with a Russian-supplied missile, killing more than 200 European citizens. EU foreign ministers are being forced to look at their own government's arms sales to Moscow. Some nations have come out in favor of an arms embargo. Lithuania's foreign minister, Linas Linkevičius, says if the EU doesn't move forward with tougher sanctions against Moscow, its inaction contributes to what he calls terrorist acts.
It must be a turning point in our mindset. I don't know what else should happen in order to understand with whom we are dealing.
But it's unlikely foreign ministers will go so far now as to cut off weapons sales. They are likely to put visa bans and asset freezes on close associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting Egyptian officials in Cairo today. They're seeking ways to tamp down the violence in Gaza. NPR